Hello, everyone out there in podcast land. Welcome back to the Nightlamp podcast.
Yes, hello from me too.
So you're with Stefan and Adela.
Hello.
So it's been, once again, a little bit of time since our last podcast.
But we've been so busy.
Very, very busy.
And barely in the same place at the same time.
No. No. So over the last month, it's been Queensland.
Queensland, Sydney.
And Victoria.
And Victoria.
And
what have lots of training.
And what have you been up to this week?
This week I've been doing training with some great groups of people and writing training. So that's what's focused my thinking this week.
What about in your spare time?
In my spare time?
Kite surfing, Adela?
I do not have any spare time, no. In my spare time, I've been, what have I been doing in my spare time? Spending time with my grandchildren and drinking nice cups of Yorkshire tea.
Oh, lovely. And I will say to our listeners that Adela, as you know, is very fussy on her Yorkshire tea.
Yes.
And it has to be made just right.
It does.
I've had a wonderful week, been also very, very busy with some consultation work and some training work, and also fit in some mountain bike riding this week. So I was very, very happy with our little Dalmatian Teddy, the Nightlamp mascot, who's learned how to mountain bike ride, but not on an actual bike.
And did you do any running up and down that mountain that you run up and down that makes you feel quite unwell?
Yes. Well, it makes you feel unwell in the short term. And that's my morning hill sprints. Amazing benefits. I will recommend it to anybody.
Yeah.
If you can withstand a little bit of feeling sick at the top of the hill, amazing long-term benefits. Yeah. You feel great for the rest of the day.
I'll take your word for it, Stefan.
You'll come with us one day. Why are you laughing?
Oh, you're introducing comedy to it, are you?
Oh,
I didn't
I'm
know we were going
serious.
To have comedy in the podcast.
I'm absolutely serious. We're getting you a Nightlamp mountain bike one day.
Are you? Mm-hmm. I think I've heard reference to this on Facebook. I laughed.
Well, some people noticed that you didn't have a mountain bike.
They would have.
It will happen.
It's quite noticeable.
Yes, yes. Well, since we spoke last, there's been so much going on out there in the news. There's been so much more progression in the land of the, well, two relevant royal commissions at the moment, the family violence and the continuing one into institutional responses to child abuse. Also, lots of stuff going on in the news. I couldn't help. I thought I'd bring along today an article from the start of the month about the prisoners rioting at the Metropolitan Remand Centre in Ravenhall, which is just out of Melbourne, earlier. And I thought we might chat about that.
Well, it does, of course, have great relevance to our main topic of interest, which is childhood trauma, because, as we all know, a very high percentage, somewhere around 95% of prisoners in correctional facilities have a history of unresolved childhood trauma.
And I think that given that, that we've got that evidence and we've got the studies that show that level, you know, that, I guess, you know, level of developmental trauma, childhood trauma in the prison population.
Yeah.
Let's have a look at this. I mean, there are many, many things that may have caused this incident. We know that. But let's break it down with only the information that we have in the news report. So we've got an article that appeared in The Age on July 1st, just reporting on the riots. And I guess we can use it as a bit of a way to talk about different aspects of possible causes from developmental trauma, but we're not necessarily analysing the actual incident,
no.
Just our thoughts as they happen to come from as a result of the article.
Yeah, and of course there will be, I think there already is, an inquiry into the actual incident, so we're
no
not
doubt.
Commenting on that.
No doubt, we're not commenting on that, just to be very, very clear.
Very clear. But what we are commenting on is the relationship between the sorts of things that happen on those occasions and childhood trauma that remains unresolved.
Exactly. Look, there's a few things that we know according to the news, right? According to the news, and the, of course, that might be flawed in itself. So according to the news, this was sparked by news that the prison was no longer going to allow prisoners to smoke cigarettes.
Which, of course, was not announced that day.
Yeah,
it's been coming for about 18 months.
Yes, that's right. That's right. But obviously something had
something
happened. It became imminent on that day somehow. So we have to actually understand the use of cigarettes from the point of view of developmental trauma and also how people react to things when they are living with developmental trauma, would you say? Because, of course, the other option is that it may have been like a planned protest against the announcement with perhaps some projected outcomes. Who knows? But let's put that to the side for now.
Yes, and I must say, looking at the images that were taken, presumably from some kind of a news helicopter, because they caught it sort of from the air, the people don't look terribly well organised.
No, we can probably venture to guess that it doesn't look like an organised protest. Not a lot of thought and planning gone into this.
In fact, it looks quite chaotic.
Yes, yeah. So I suppose the other thing left, and the thing that makes me think about all the, I mean, many of the cases that you and I have known of children and adults who live with developmental trauma is an extremely elevated baseline of arousal and that people react to things.
And I think that often people don't quite understand what that actually means. Like, they're words and we say them.
Yeah.
You and I might understand from that a different meaning than the average person. And I think it's important to say that we judge others, usually, from our own point of reference. Like, what do we feel, what do we think, and how do we operate internally?
Yeah.
One of the problems in terms of that in relation to people who have experienced childhood trauma is that, in fact, their internal landscape is totally different. And so if we attempt to judge them from the point of view of how we operate, we're really going to get it wrong. And we're not only are we going to get it wrong, but we're going to apply expectations that don't apply.
Yeah, it's interesting because last week I did some training with a group of professionals. And one of the participants came to me and said, well, I just go by my gut feeling rather than all this knowledge of stuff, right? All these theories. I work from my intuition and my gut feeling. And my response was, well, that would be appropriate if your gut feeling was right and aligned with an understanding, but what if your gut was wrong? What then?
Or what if your gut is gauged and determined by how you see the world?
And have you been raised?
And all of those things. So gut feelings, which, you know, I know, and particularly in the youth work field, well, not wanting to sound in any way pejorative, but in the youth work field there's been, over many, many years, a really strong focus on relationship and using your gut and your connection, all of which is great, as long as that's not all you rely on.
No. So at some point, I think you and I both have this experience where we might attend a meeting or a forum and we begin talking about theory. And I've had this experience before in local government where I'm sitting down at a meeting with councillors, so local politicians, who, because they know me begin to roll their eyes as soon as I start talking about theory, almost like, oh, here he goes again. But
I've had that experience too.
I'm sure you have. Actually, I've seen people have that
reaction
when you speak.
Yeah.
But it's because we have got to put this kind of lens of the theory in front of us so that we're not as marred. We're still marred by our own experience and our own intuition, but we've got to use something, don't we, as a reference point, which is something other than our own experience, ourselves.
And so when we say, for example, going back to the original point, people who have childhood trauma have a heightened and elevated baseline of arousal, what do we mean?
Yeah.
What we mean is that they're hypervigilant, hyper-aroused, and that they are both emotionally, well, three things, neurobiologically, emotionally, and physiologically, not in the same state as you or I when we go into any interaction. They are operating from a different place.
Yeah.
And they are also operating from a place where there is less choice about how they may react to circumstances. So we say, oh, it was his choice. He chose to behave in that way. Well, no.
Because we would be able to make a choice.
We would be able to make the choice. Yeah. Yeah. And the reason we would be able to make the choice well is because we'd be thinking. Whereas, of course, we know from all the literature about how our physiology takes over and our brains actually start to shut down into more primitive functions when the higher up the arousal continuum we move, if that's the case, then someone who's very heightened, perhaps because they think they're not going to be allowed to smoke, the one thing that gets them through the day.
Yeah.
Yep. The thought of a cigarette, which, of course, is a terrible addiction, but we know that, and that's something else. That's another part of it.
It's a different matter.
But because this is going and it's being taken away from them, they will be in a state of some arousal. They will be less able to think, more chaotic internally, and more primitive in their functioning.
So I guess because their baseline of arousal is a lot higher
already
than someone who is not traumatised in childhood.
Exactly.
Right? So anyone would react to a sudden change, especially to an emotional prop being taken away.
Exactly.
You know, for many people out there, if they were told, right, from now on you can't have chocolate, or they might just go, oh, well, you know, well, I could have it sometimes.
Or Yorkshire tea.
Or Yorkshire tea. Imagine if I took that away from you.
Oh, don't try.
We'd have a riot.
You would. A night lamp riot. But yes, but because I come from a lowered baseline, presumably, I would be able to rationally work it through.
Now, if your baseline was heightened, and I told you that there was no more Yorkshire tea, that you had to have Lipton's.
Big trouble.
Then we'd have a problem because you'd be slightly heightened, but already so close to a fight or flight response that you may not be able to think at all.
Or indeed I might dissociate completely.
Yeah.
These are the things that happen when people are in a heightened state. Yeah. And we're being a little bit flippant, but the fact of the matter is that if seriously I was in a heightened state, I wouldn't take it too well. And I wouldn't be thinking.
It's like when we hear bad news. If someone that we love has passed away, or something, you know, terrible is coming, or the cyclone on the way, people become a little bit heightened. Or, you know, some people, it could be as little as walking into a job interview. Well, and they think, well, I couldn't think. You know, I didn't say what I wanted to say because I just couldn't think of it.
Yeah. Let me give you an example from my own life this week, where I walked out of a shop, having left my car 5 minutes too long in a clear way, and it was gone.
Yep.
And, of course, it had been towed away. I couldn't think. I'm telling you, I took out my phone to work out what to do, and I couldn't even A traffic offence is not a criminal offence, I'm at pains to point out. I took my phone, my mobile phone out, and I couldn't actually even remember how to work it. And I had to say to myself, come on, say it all, before I could actually find how to Google the city of Moreland.
Yeah.
And find the right number to find the place that my car had been taken to.
But I would venture to guess, because your arousal baseline is at a healthy level, you are actually able to regulate yourself so that you could actually function cognitively and think and do those things. Because I spoke to you, I rang
half
you.
Half an hour later.
It was probably half an hour later.
Yeah.
And you sounded fine.
Yeah.
You said to me, oh, well, I shouldn't have done that, and I'm here and I'm just about to pick up my car. And I just thought, wow, I'd be ropeable.
You're really
calm.
So I'm quite good at regulating myself, but I can tell you in the first 5 minutes, I wasn't.
But if you weren't able to soothe yourself after that, then there may have been a one-woman riot on Sydney Road.
Yeah. Well, I could have stomped up and down, and I could have created, I would have got through to City of Moreland, and I would have ripped shreds off the girl on the phone. All of these things would have happened if I had been less able to regulate myself.
So going back to the prison, right, here was a situation where people are living in this environment, which is an unnatural environment and rather stressful environment.
Absolutely.
And they've got one prop that they can use to, I must say, probably quite maladaptively soothe themselves. And because we're talking about a large number of the population who aren't able to do what you did.
Exactly.
Of course, they will use cigarettes.
Yeah.
For that purpose.
Exactly.
Right? So now the panic is, I won't have my regulator. Mm. How will I regulate myself emotionally? Mm. And that, I think that turns into a loop that's unstoppable. Mm.
And of course, riot. Where does the riot come from? Well, you have a concentration of people who have very poor capacity to self-regulate. So if you have one or two and and the rest of the group are well able to settle, they would calm them down. But there would have been a certain contagion element.
Oh, of course.
Because we're talking about a group of people, all of whom have great difficulty in regulating
and
themselves.
And also, what's arousing for any person is somebody else behaving in a hyper-aroused way.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you and I... Mm. Were sitting somewhere and someone started yelling and behaving aggressively, then we'd become heightened as well.
And we'd have to try and calm ourselves down.
But we could do it.
We
could, as you proved
this week. As I proved. but of course, yes, in that environment, they're all people who have great difficulty regulating themselves.
So then you've got this snowball.
Right.
A snowball effect. A snowball effect for each individual as they snowball their arousal into more and more
up,
more and more fight or flight kind of response and less thinking, because we think less as we try and survive. We go into survival more.
As Bruce Perry says, stress makes us dumb.
Indeed, it can. I mean, for all of us.
Mm. Yeah. The more stressed we get, the more up the arousal continuum we go, the further down in our brain function we go, and the more primitive our functioning becomes. So we aren't thinking.
My former manager many, many years ago once said to me, because I had applied for another position and interviewed, I didn't get the job, and he said to me, "You just do burnouts, mate. You do burnouts." And I said, "What's that mean?" He goes, "You're just going really, really fast and getting nowhere with everything that you say." And that was the level of my anxiety. You know, that's exactly what's happening. We really can't think. We can't think when we're in that state.
Think. And in fact, people who do well, for example, in exams, are largely people who manage themselves well, who learn how to regulate themselves when under stress. It's not that they're not stressed.
Exactly. Yeah.
They have learnt ways of managing themselves and calming themselves and regulating themselves.
And sports people. Mm. I mean, you look at anybody in any sports, those who compete really, really well, and part of sports psychology is the ability to ensure you're aroused, you have enough arousal to perform well, but not too much that you can't think at all.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. So, you know, and there are many implications, obviously, for our work in this, and we do a lot of work with children in schools. And what we often see is that children are perceived as having made a choice when they are so aroused that they are not able to make a cognitive choice at all, to actually make decisions about their behaviour. And so what happens is they're usually punished or they receive some sort of consequence afterwards for their behaviour.
Because it is believed that it was a choice.
Yeah, yeah. It's seen as malicious, like you were naughty.
Yeah.
And I heard some talk about one child once recently, just just the other day, who said of himself, the principal, who is just a fantastic principal that we've done a lot of work with, said to the child, "Oh, what are you doing out of the class?" And he said, "Well, I've been naughty. Well, I am naughty, so this is what I do." And they begin to get this idea of themselves that they're kind of bad, and I don't think that does them any favours in the long run.
And I would hazard to say, although this is probably controversial, but I'll say it anyway because it's never stopped me in the past.
I think we need to say at least one controversial thing in every podcast.
I think that generally speaking, it is adults who teach children to be naughty.
Yeah.
Because we label their behaviour. We tell them. Now, if we don't want children to be naughty, and I use the inverted comma sign, then we need to stop telling them that certain behaviours are naughty and define them as something else.
Well, it makes me think about the second part of my conversation with this principal, and I hope you're listening because I did really appreciate it. Was that he said to the child, he said, "Oh, you mean you're not feeling happy," right? And it's just such
lovely.
A perfect response.
Yeah.
Because then the child can actually understand, this little boy can actually understand, oh, I'm not naughty. Yes, that's right. I'm actually feeling unhappy. And that's very different, isn't it?
It's very different because it begins to teach some emotional literacy. So saying to a child that's naughty actually doesn't teach them anything. And it prospers them not one jot in terms of being able to not do what it is you don't want them to do.
Yeah, exactly.
So if we don't want kids to do certain things, and I'm talking about all children now, I'm not talking about children with developmental trauma. I'm talking about just ordinary parenting of healthy children. If we don't want children to do things, then we have to start working with them from the inside out instead of the outside in. The outside in, put the label on. It won't do any good. The inside out is what do you feel that causes you to do that? Let's deal with the feeling.
I like that idea of emotional literacy that you're talking about. And it's something that, it's an idea that all parents...
Absolutely.
Would be really advantaged to have a really good sense of building the capacity for emotional literacy.
Yeah. It's the long way, though. It is the harder path. It's, as M. Scott Peck described it in his book, The Road Less Travelled.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is the better road to take.
Well, it's about long-term results.
Absolutely.
I mean, when we're raising children, we're actually raising people and adults. So most parents, want to have a good day with their child and want good behaviour, but most parents want good things in the adulthood
Indeed.
Of their children, don't they?
They do, and even parents who have extremely problematic approaches to their children actually want to do better.
Yeah.
They just don't know how to.
Well, every parent that we have worked with traumatised children wants the best thing for their children.
But
and
sometimes,
they may not know.
Yeah, sometimes it's elusive to them because of their own experiences or because something else gets in the way. In terms of helping children to be what I like to call their best self, if we label pejoratively and take the shortcut will make us feel better in the short term.
In the short term, it will make us feel
like we're doing something.
Yeah. I reckon even more than that, it makes us feel like we have control.
Absolutely.
But it's a bit of an illusion.
It is a total illusion.
We don't actually have control.
It's a complete illusion, and I think I said this in an earlier podcast. If we use our physical size to control a child, like, you know, the average child up to the age of 7 or 8, you can pick them up and remove them from anything they're doing. Mm-hmm. You can put them in their room. You can do that. It's a very unwise mechanism to adopt because it only lasts as long as they're smaller than you.
Yeah, it's a kind of, it's really...
That's what you rely on.
It's an approach that's about use of force. Mm. It's like, I'm stronger than this child. So what happens when this kid gets big?
Bigger.
Big and, enough to do damage and to injure and to assault. And so all of a sudden, I mean, we're creeping into the realm even of family violence in there.
We
a
are.
Different way of understanding family violence, which I'm sure in a future podcast we'll have a very good conversation about. I'd love to talk about it.
We will, but we won't go there today,
Not today.
Because it's a very big topic and also very strongly related to childhood trauma.
Yeah.
But also controversially so, because there are paradigms of understanding.
Are you going to be controversial twice?
I
in one
probably
podcast?
Am, but I'll only allude to it, and we'll be more controversial in the podcast we actually do on the topic of family violence.
A controversy.
What do you call it? A trailer.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
A trailer of controversy. But in fact, there are frameworks, political, socio-political frameworks about family violence that would find it very controversial to start going down the path of understanding, because there are people who believe that if you are understanding, that means you're excusing.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're two very different things. But let's stop there for
okay, I'm going to stop you right there.
Yeah, stop me right there.
Otherwise we'll be
because
in trouble.
We won't go down. We need to wait until we've got time to focus on it. Back to being heightened and choice. And whether or not you're in a position to make a choice when you're in a heightened state.
And I mean, it's we can extend this conversation because we've been talking about a riot in a prison, but this extends to all sorts of behaviour that then becomes criminal behaviour. So where do you stop? You know, it's a very, very interesting. We always find this a very interesting topic, but we're not saying necessarily that there's an immediate answer. But there is a way, there are different ways of understanding that helps us to deal with situations. And like you said earlier, you know, you were hinting at this to do with family violence. It doesn't excuse behaviour. It doesn't mean that we have to let it happen. It means that we've got an understanding of it that actually enables us to manage it easier. Like if we understand it, we can manage it.
Yeah, and we're less controlled by it.
Yes, that's right.
Because if we apply a framework of understanding that is compassionate and actually recognises the human pain that sits beneath a lot of very unacceptable behaviour, that doesn't mean we excuse it. That doesn't mean that we say, oh, that's all right, you be violent. Not at all. It just means that we actually have a much better, I suppose, control over our own response.
Yeah, yeah.
And if we have a better control over our own response, we're going to be able to respond rather than react. Because you can think about it.
That's the mistake that we often make as parents or as carers or even sometimes as prison guards or whatever our work might be. Now, I'm led to believe that the prison staff dealt with this really, really well, considering the circumstance. So I nothing to say there. I wouldn't have liked to be in that situation as one of the staff either, or as one of the inmates. And I've worked in prisons, and they can be really harrowing places to work sometimes. And in general, prisons do quite well in keeping arousal fairly low. And you think about the predictability of routine.
Yep.
It's not a bad thing. There's most definitely containment, right? But there are some things that could add, obviously, to the framework and to knowing, once we have that.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting, in fact, that although there is a punitive element, obviously, in prisons, many of the and punitive responses don't actually achieve very much in terms of people with developmental trauma. But the other elements that you've referred to are very important elements of assisting people to manage their responses.
Exactly. Predictability, routine, containment, safety, knowing that you are, knowing that you're safe, which of course when that goes out the window, then obviously arousal can go up. Well, pretty thorough discussion.
Yes, and I think it's a discussion that we may do more work on.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I think would be good in a future podcast, whether it's the one where we talk about family violence or whether it's another, I think that issue of whether behaviour is a choice or not is one that's probably worthwhile exploring more. Because I think it's a very important question for people to answer in terms of how they work with people who've experienced trauma and, in fact, with people who haven't. So if you're dealing, I think often when we're talking, we're speaking about people who have experienced childhood trauma, who grapple with certain particular elements in their lives.
Yeah.
And people think we're talking about everybody.
Yeah.
And often when we're talking about children, people think we're talking about all children. We're not talking about all children. We're talking about children who've experienced developmental trauma. Children who haven't and who are healthy may very well be naughty.
Yeah.
Healthy children are naughty. And we're not saying that you should never apply consequences, real consequences, to a child. It's really a matter of what sits behind behaviour that is really important to be able to identify.
When you understand the populations of, for example, prisons or other sections like out-of-home care, residential care, now we know how many of those children are living with developmental trauma histories, right?
Because they wouldn't be in long-term out-of-home care otherwise.
They wouldn't be there. Yeah. And one of the comments that that I got from some training I did last week in Sydney was that knowing that children or young people are not making a choice to behave in that way actually empowers us as carers to be able to help them through that. Because thinking that it's just their choice puts us in a battle, and a battle is the wrong place for anything therapeutic. Mm.
That's right. Well, as always, Stefan, we've covered some interesting topics.
Well, thanks for the chat.
I've enjoyed this one. And I think it leads us naturally on to some other ones in future.
Indeed. I think we've got quite a few there and lots of opportunities for you to be controversial in the future.
Yes.
Make sure you've always got opportunities for that.
I love to be controversial. But also would I'd be really interested, and I know you would be, in people's comments about some of the stuff we've talked about today.
Yes, well, I would ask people to please make comment, contact us. You can find our website on nightlamp.org, and that's night beginning with a K, as in a one with shining armour. Look up nightlamp.org, and also look up Nightlamp on Facebook, and you can make comments there, and we're happy to always engage in conversations and discussions, and also ideas for future podcasts as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Things that perhaps people would like to start, conversations that people would like to start that we could actually get going on the podcast would be good.
So thank you very much for joining us once again.
Thank you for your interest. Bye-bye.
Catch you next time.